matter. He has committed himself to this course of action, and he has to see it through. As he nears the door, he sees headlights arcing around, about to turn toward him. He pulls open the door to the truck sleeper, hurls himself inside, and pulls the door closed behind him. He sits on a bed not much bigger than a cot, catching his breath. What's his next move? The trucker will be back. Connor has about 5 minutes if he's lucky, 1 minute if he's not. He peers beneath the bed. There's space down there where he can hide, but it's blocked by 2 duffel bags full of clothes. He could pull them out, squeeze in, and pull the duffel bags back in front of him. The trucker would never know he's there. But even before he can get the first duffel bag out, the door swings open. Connor just stands there, unable to react as the trucker reaches in to grab his jacket and sees him.
Whoa! Who are you? What the hell are you doing in my truck?
A police car cruises slowly past behind him.
Please!
Connor says, his voice suddenly squeaky like it was before his voice changed.
Please don't tell anyone. I've got to get out of this place.
He reaches into his backpack, fumbling, and pulls out a wad of bills from his wallet.
You want money? I've got money. I'll give you all I've got.
I don't want your money, the trucker says.
All right, then what?
Even in the dim light, the trucker must see the panic in Connor's eyes, but he doesn't say a thing.
Please, says Connor again. I'll do anything you want.
The trucker looks at him in silence for a moment more.
Is that so?
He finally says. Then he steps inside and closes the door behind him. Connor shuts his eyes, not daring to consider what he's just gotten himself into. The trucker sits beside him.
What's your name?
Connor.
Then he realizes a moment too late he should have given a fake name. The trucker scratches his beard stubble and thinks for a moment.
Let me show you something, Connor.
He reaches over Connor and grabs, of all things, a deck of cards from a little pouch hanging next to the bed.
Do you ever see this?
The trucker takes the deck of cards in one hand and does a skillful one-handed shuffle.
Pretty good, huh?
Connor, not knowing what to say, just nods.
How about this?
Then the trucker takes a single card and with sleight of hand makes the card vanish into thin air. Then he reaches over and pulls the card right out of Connor's shirt pocket.
You like that?
Connor lets out a nervous laugh.
Well, those tricks you just saw, the trucker says, I didn't do them.
I don't know what you mean.
The trucker rolls up his sleeve to reveal that the arm, which had done the tricks, had been grafted on at the elbow.
10 years ago, I fell asleep at the wheel, the trucker tells him. Big accident. I lost an arm, a kidney, and a few other things. I got new ones, though, and I pulled through.
He looks at his hands, and now Connor can see that the trick card hand is a little different from the other one. The trucker's other hand has thicker fingers, and the skin is a bit more olive in tone.
So, says Connor, you got dealt a new hand.
The trucker laughs at that. Then he becomes quiet for a moment, looking at his replacement hand.
These fingers here knew things the rest of me didn't. Muscle memory, they call it. And there's not a day that goes by that I don't wonder what other incredible things that kid who owned this arm knew before he was unwound, whoever he was.
The trucker stands up.
You're lucky you came to me, he says. There are truckers out there who'll take whatever you offer and turn you in anyway.
And you're not like that?
No, I'm not.
And he puts out his hand, his other hand, and Connor shakes it.
Josias Aldridge, he says. I'm heading north from here. You can ride with me till morning.
Connor's relief is so great, it takes the wind right out of him. He can't even offer a thank you.
That bed there's not the most comfortable in the world, says Aldridge. But it does the job. Get yourself some rest. I just gotta go take a dump and then we'll be on our way.
Then he closes the door and Connor listens to his footsteps heading off toward the bathroom. Connor finally lets his guard down and begins to feel his own exhaustion. The trucker didn't give him a destination, just a direction. And that's fine. North, south, east, west, it doesn't matter, as long as it's away from here. As for his next move, well, first he's got to get through this one before he can think about what comes next. A minute later, Connor's already beginning to doze when he hears the shout from outside. "We know you're in there! Come out now and you won't get hurt!" Connor's heart sinks. Josias Aldridge has apparently pulled another sleight of hand. He's made Connor appear for the police. Abracadabra. With his journey over before it even began, Connor swings the door open to see three juvie cops aiming weapons. But they're not aiming at him. In fact, their backs are to him. Across the way, the cab door swings open of the truck he had hidden under just a few minutes before, and a kid comes out from behind the empty driver's seat, his hands in the air. Connor recognizes him right away. It's a kid he knows from school, Andy Jameson.
My God, is Andy being unwound too?
There's a look of fear on Andy's face, but beyond it is something worse. A look of utter defeat. That's when Connor realizes his own folly. He'd been so surprised by this turn of events that he's still just standing there, exposed for anyone to see. Well, the policemen don't see him, but Andy does. He catches sight of Connor, holds his gaze, only for a moment. And in that moment, something remarkable happens. The look of despair on Andy's face is suddenly replaced by a steely resolve bordering on triumph. He quickly looks away from Connor and takes a few steps before the police grab him. Steps away from Connor, so that the police still have their backs to him. Andy had seen him and had not given him away. If Andy has nothing else after this day, at least he'll have this small victory. Connor leans back into the shadows of the truck and slowly pulls the door closed. Outside, as the police take Andy away, Connor lies back down, and his tears come as sudden as a summer downpour. He's not sure who he's crying for Andy, for himself, for Ariana. And not knowing makes his tears flow all the more. Instead of wiping the tears away, he lets them dry on his face like he used to when he was a little boy, and the things he cried about were so insignificant that they'd be forgotten by morning. The trucker never comes to check on him. Instead, Connor hears the engine start and feels the truck pulling out. The gentle motion of the road rocks him to sleep. The ring of Connor's cell phone wakes him out of a deep sleep. He fights consciousness. He wants to go back to the dream he was having. It was about a place he was sure he had been to, although he couldn't quite remember when. He was at a cabin on a beach with his parents, before his brother was born. Connor's leg had fallen through a rotted board on the porch into spider webs so thick they felt like cotton. Connor had screamed and screamed from the pain and the fear of the giant spiders that he was convinced would eat his leg off. And yet, this was a good dream, a good memory, because his father was there to pull him free and carry him inside, where they bandaged his leg and sat him by the fire with some kind of cider so flavorful he could still taste it when he thought about it. His father told him a story that he can no longer remember, but that's all right. It wasn't the story, but the tone of his voice that mattered. A gentle baritone rumble as calming as waves breaking on a shore. Little boy Connor drank his cider and leaned back against his mother, pretending to fall asleep. But what he was really doing was trying to dissolve into the moment and make it last forever. In the dream, he did dissolve. His whole being flowed into the cider cup, and his parents placed it gently on the table, close enough to the fire to keep it warm forever and always. Stupid dreams. Even the good ones are bad, because they remind you how poorly reality measures up. His cell phone rings again, chasing away the last of the dream. Connor almost answers it. The sleeper room of the truck is so dark, he doesn't realize at first that he's not in his own bed. The only thing that saves him is that he can't find his phone, and he must turn on a light. When he finds a wall where his nightstand should be, he realizes that this isn't his room. The phone rings again. That's when it all comes back to him, and he remembers where he is. Connor finds his phone in his backpack. The phone ID says the call is from his father. So now his parents know he's gone. Do they really think he'll answer his phone? He waits until voicemail takes the call, then he turns off the power. His watch says 7:30 a.m. He rubs the sleep out of his eyes, trying to calculate how far they've come. The truck isn't moving anymore, but they must have traveled at least 200 miles while he slept. It's a good start. There's a knock on the door.
Come on out, kid. Your ride's over.
Connor's not complaining. It was outrageously generous of this truck driver to do what he did. Connor won't ask any more of him. He swings open the door and steps out to thank the man, but it's not Josias Aldridge at the door. Aldridge is a few yards away being handcuffed, and in front of Connor is a policeman, a juvie cop wearing a smile as big as all outdoors. Standing 10 yards away is Connor's father, still holding the cell phone he had just called from.
It's over, son, his father says. It makes Connor furious.
I'm not your son, he wants to shout. I stopped being your son when you signed the unwind order.
But the shock of the moment leaves him speechless. It had been so stupid of Connor to leave his cell phone on. That's how they tracked him. And he wonders how many other kids are caught by their own blind trust of technology. Well, Connor's not going the way Andy Jameson did. He quickly assesses the situation. The truck has been pulled over to the side of the interstate by two highway patrol cars and a juvie cop unit. Traffic barrels past at 70 miles per hour, oblivious to the little drama unfolding on the shoulder. Connor makes a split-second decision and bolts, pushing the officer against the truck and racing across the busy highway. Would they shoot an unarmed kid in the back, he wonders? Or would they shoot him in the legs and spare his vital organs? As he races onto the interstate, cars swerve around him, but he keeps on going.
Connor, stop!
He hears his father yell. Then he hears a gunfire. He feels the impact, but not in his skin. The bullet embeds in his backpack. He doesn't look behind him. Then, as he reaches the highway median, he hears another gunshot, and a small blue splotch appears on the center divider. They're firing tranquilizer bullets. They're not taking him out. They're trying to take him down. And they're much more likely to fire trank bullets at will than regular bullets. Connor climbs over the center divider and finds himself in the path of a Cadillac that's not stopping for anything. The car swerves to avoid him, and by sheer luck, Connor's momentum takes him just a few inches out of the caddy's path. Its side mirror smacks him painfully in the ribs before the car screeches to a halt, sending the acrid stench of burned rubber up his nostrils. Holding his aching side, Connor sees someone looking at him from an open window of the back seat. It's another kid, dressed all in white. The kid is terrified. With the police already reaching the center divider, Connor looks into the eyes of this frightened kid and knows what he has to do. It's time for another split-second decision. He reaches through the window, pulls up the lock, and opens the door. 2. Risa. Risa paces backstage, waiting for her turn at the piano. She knows she could play the sonata in her sleep. In fact, she often does. So many nights she would wake up to feel her fingers playing on the bedsheets. She would hear the music in her head, and it would still play for a few moments after she awoke. But then it would dissolve into the night, leaving nothing but her fingers drumming against the covers. She has to know the sonata. It has to come to her as easily as breathing.
It's not a competition, Mr. Durkin always tells her. There are no winners or losers at a recital.
Well, Risa knows better.
Risa Ward, the stage manager calls. You're up.
She rolls her shoulders, adjusts the barrette in her long brown hair, then she takes the stage. The applause from the audience is polite, nothing more. Some of it is genuine, for she does have friends out there, and teachers who want her to succeed. But mostly it's the obligatory applause from an audience waiting to be impressed. Mr. Durkin is out there. He has been her piano teacher for 5 years.
He's the closest thing Risa has to a parent. She's lucky. Not every kid at Ohio State Home 23 has a teacher they can say that about. Most stay-ho kids hate their teachers, because they see them as jailers. Ignoring the stiff formality of a recital dress, she sits at the piano. It's a concert Steinway as ebony as the night, and just as long. Focus. She keeps her eyes on the piano, forcing the audience to recede into darkness. The audience doesn't matter. All that matters is the piano and the glorious sound she's about to charm out of it. She holds her fingers above the keys for a moment, then begins with perfect passion. Soon her fingers dance across the keys, making the flawless seem facile. She makes the instrument sing, and then her left ring finger stumbles on a B flat, slipping awkwardly onto B natural. A mistake. It happens so quickly, it could go unnoticed, but not by Risa. She holds the wrong note in her mind, and even as she continues playing, that note reverberates within her, growing to a crescendo, stealing her focus until she slips again into a second wrong note, and then, 2 minutes later, blows an entire chord. Tears begin to fill her eyes, and she can't see clearly.
"You don't need to see," she tells herself. "You just need to feel the music."
She can still pull out of this nosedive, can't she? Her mistakes, which sound so awful to her, are barely noticeable.
"Relax," Mr. Durkin would tell her. "No one is judging you."
Perhaps he truly believes that, but then he can afford to believe it. He's not 15, and he's never been a ward of the state. 5 mistakes. Every one of them is small, subtle, but they are mistakes nonetheless. It would have been fine if any of the other kids' performances were less than stellar, but the others shined. Still, Mr. Durkin is all smiles when he greets Risa at the reception.
"You are marvelous," he says. "I'm proud of you." "I stunk up the stage."
"Nonsense. You chose one of Chopin's most difficult pieces. Professionals can't get through it without an error or two. You did it justice."
"I need more than justice."
Mr. Durkin sighs, but he doesn't deny it.
"You're coming along nicely. I look forward to the day I see those hands playing in Carnegie Hall."
His smile is warm and genuine, as are the congratulations from the other girls in her dorm. It's enough warmth to ease her sleep that night, and to give her hope that maybe, just maybe, she's making too much of it and being unnecessarily hard on herself. She falls asleep thinking of what she might choose to play next. 1 week later, she's called into the headmaster's office. There are 3 people there. A tribunal, thinks Risa. 3 adults sitting in judgment, like the 3 monkeys. Hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil.
"Please sit down, Risa," says the headmaster.
She tries to sit gracefully, but her knees, now unsteady, won't allow it. She slaps awkwardly down into a chair far too plush for an inquisition. Risa doesn't know the other 2 people sitting beside the headmaster, but they both look very official. Their demeanor is relaxed, as if this is business as usual for them. The woman to the headmaster's left identifies herself as the social worker assigned to Risa's case. Until that moment, Risa didn't know she had a case. She says her name, Ms. Something or Other. The name never even makes it into Risa's memory. She flips through the pages of Risa's 15 years of life as casually as if she were reading a newspaper.
"Let's see. You've been a ward of the state from birth. It looks like your behavior has been exemplary. Your grades have been respectable, but not excellent."
Then the social worker looks up and smiles.
"I saw your performance the other night. You were very good."
"Good," thinks Risa, "but not excellent." Ms. Something or Other leafs through the folder for a few seconds more, but Risa can tell she's not really looking. Whatever's going on here was decided long before Risa walked through the door.
"Why am I here?"
Ms. Something or Other closes her folder and glances at the headmaster and the man beside him in an expensive suit. The suit nods, and the social worker turns back to Risa with a warm smile.
"We feel you've reached your potential here," she says. "Headmaster Thomas and Mr. Paulson are in agreement with me."
Risa glances at the suit. "Who's